Hello and welcome to Bright Wings, children's books to make the heart soar. I am your host, Charity Hill. The purpose of this conversation is to help mothers and fathers identify books that will liberate their children to embrace truth, goodness, and beauty.
One of the purposes of Bright Wings is to educate parents and to help us become more aware, more thoughtful, more intentional, and wise as we educate and form our children. And so joining me in this mission today, I have Mr. Jeremy Adams. So thank you for joining me today, Mr. Adams, and welcome to Bright Wings, children's books to make the heart soar.
Thank you. Absolutely honored to be here today. Thank you.
So, Mr. Adams, you're a father and you are an outstanding educator. You've been one of the most decorated educators in California. And in 2018, you were the first classroom teacher that was inducted into the California State University Bakersfield Hall of Fame. You're an alum of Washington and Lee University and CSU Bakersfield. And you've written on politics and education for the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Sacramento Bee, and
Public Discourse, where you wrote an article titled The Death of Gratitude in the American Classroom. Not only that, you've recently published a book called Hollowed Out, a warning about America's next generation. You're really embedded in your community and you're thinking and writing a lot about it. You've been a teacher for quite a number of years. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so I've been a teacher, I can't believe I'm saying this, my 24th year in the classroom. I always make the joke to my students that I know I look like I'm way too young to be a person who's been teaching for almost a quarter of a century, but I actually teach at the high school where I attended. So, you know, I graduated from Bakersfield High School in 1994, and I was already back teaching in the fall of 98. And wow. So this is a place that has very deep roots for me. My father, who just passed away a few weeks ago, was one of those teachers. You know, one of those extraordinary kind of teacher celebrities, I call them. You know, you couldn't go anywhere with my dad without former students or parents coming up to him. And he taught at that high school. I met my future wife at that high school. So it really is a home that I could never find anywhere else. And I've also been teaching at a public university for 15 years at CSU Bakersfield. I never thought any Hall of Fame would let me into it. I certainly wasn't ever going to be in a sports Hall of Fame. So I'm glad that I was accepted into a university Hall of Fame. But I really am a profound believer in digging deep into your own community. I think when I was younger, you know, anybody with a patina of passion and ambition wants to be in history books and, you know, wants to be in national headlines. And the older I get, the more I see the value, the virtue, and the happiness that you get by being a fixture in your own community, right? It's better to have a school named after you than a state named after you when it comes to a happy and fulfilled life. And so, you know, I always say that when I walk across my high school campus, the wind is never cold because I'm at home and it's warm and it is my community. And so that's all I've ever done with my life. It's all I ever want to do with my life. The writing, I'm quite surprised at how huge and successful it's gotten. But I think that's because I'm writing about a place and about a subject that I care passionately about.
I love that you're so rooted in the place where you went to high school, the place where you grew up. It's getting rarer and rarer in our super mobile world. And we need people who are rooted. I wish I was had been more rooted, but inevitably we've moved a ton. I also grew up in a small town and I couldn't go anywhere without my dad recognizing the waitress or the people who worked at Dairy Queen or, you know, he was always meeting former students, and even some of my friends' parents used to be his students. And so I think he taught for 38 years in our school district.
Wow.
So I have some sense of what your consistency at Bakersfield is like, and I think it gives you a kind of credibility that's hard to come by. Mr. Adams, 2 weeks ago, I had parent-teacher conferences, and I had seven of them on the schedule, but I ended up having about nine because I had a couple of informal ones in the hallway. I listened to plenty of honest feedback about my children, things they were doing well and areas of needed growth. I'd like to think of this conversation as a grand parent-teacher conference where you help us to understand what is happening with our young people.
Yeah.
So your book, Hollowed Out, demonstrates, quote, that the chief danger to this generation is one of disengagement, of being unwilling to employ reason, heart, and spirit of not forging deep and meaningful connections to people, places, and traditions. And yet they are willing to embrace and celebrate a me-ism that would make Narcissus blush. So I would love it if you would tell us about our young people, Mr. Adams.
Yeah.
What is happening? I think what you have seen, and part of the mission that I have on Bright Wings, is that I want to pour meaning into my children. I want to help pour meaning into the lives of families, of little children, and of young people. I want them to be nourished with truth and goodness and beauty. And what you're saying is that in your book, Hollowed Out, right? It came out this year.
It's actually still kind of new. It's not even 3 months old. It came out in August. Yeah. So it's
awesome.
Just out
so
there,
in yeah. Hollowed Out, you're saying that there's been an evacuation of meaning.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so first of all, I'm going to rip you off one of these days. You said, I would like to pour meaning into the lives and souls of young people. I'm going to rip you off one of these days. I hope you're okay with that. But the whole point of the book is that there is something qualitatively different happening with this generation of young people. Now, when you write a big book, you kind of are told that people are going to come after you, and people are going to, you know, you have trolls and people who are mean. And I'm just, you know, I'm an ordinary person, so I'm not a public person. So it's kind of weird when people come after you a little bit. But what's interesting is I have been truly and colossally shocked at how many people are in complete denial about how uniquely perilous our young people are today. The knee-jerk denialism that I hear is the same over and over. Well, every single generation thinks the next one is going downhill. You know, you're just a curmudgeon and a crank. And my response is, first of all, I am way too young to be a curmudgeon. Right? I think you've got to be, you know, you have to have some gray hair to be a curmudgeon, right? The second thing I would say is that I'm not making this up. This is the most unhappy generation of young Americans in the history of our country. And it's not the last 50 or 60 years. It's the last 5 to 10 years. The great thing about having taught in the classroom for 24 years is that I can see the qualitative changes. Yeah, I can see where things are pivoting, and they're not good. When you look at the word that I hear from my students all the time, anxiety, 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 the statistics don't lie. The amount of suicide has increased by over 50% in the last 10 years. The amount of self-harm of young people has increased by over 60% in the last 10 years. And if you want to hear one of the most disturbing statistics you'll ever hear, 1 out of 4 18 to 25-year-olds in this country is considered suicide. Let me say that again. 1 out of 4 18 to 25-year-olds, that was a study done by the CDC last year, has considered suicide. Now, why is that? That's because the very things that we live for, the things that give our lives joy and exuberance and grandeur and enchantment and all these fancy words that we read about in poems and plays and scripture, guess what? It's not there for this generation of young people. They are the loneliest, most untethered generation in our history. They're not around adults. They don't read. They don't go to church. They don't date. They don't particularly want to have families. 1 out of 5 millennials say they don't have a good friend in the entire world. The data is overwhelming that they are uniquely hollowed out of the behaviors and the values that give people a sense of meaning and place in the world. So, you know, you can say, well, this is, you know, every generation thinks the next one is in trouble. Okay, that's true. But at one point, some of them, you know, are in trouble. And that's exactly why, you know, I see this as a teacher. You know, if you're a high school teacher, you're never going to be famous. You're never going to be rich. But the one thing we have going for us is that sometimes we see things a bit earlier than everybody else. So I wrote Hollowed Out, and I went through it. If any of your listeners are writers, you know that trying to get a book published by a major publisher is a colossally self-defeating, deflating, up at dawn, pride swallowing siege to do it. And yet I did it because I believed in the power and the poignancy of the message. I think teachers across this country want to scream and wave, there is something not right here, but you know, we don't have a million Twitter followers. We're not running for office, so people don't hear us.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
I don't know. Absolutely. Yeah. That sounds absolutely true. What platform does a high school teacher have?
Exactly.
To get people's attention. So tell us about You've got a couple of chapters here where you outline what you're seeing, right?
Yeah.
A hollow generation, hollowed out selves, hollowed out culture, hollowed out schools, hollowed out homes, hollowed out democracy. So which one do you want to pick?
Since this is largely about reading and about books, I do think that when you talk about kind of hollowed out selves, one of the things that bothers me, and I've really seen this post-pandemic. The book is so relevant in the post-pandemic world here when kids are having so much problem reattaching to activities in school and places and focusing and putting their devices down. What's interesting is most of these problems were present before. I mean, the book was written, a lot of it was written during the pandemic, but these ideas have been floating around for a few years now. I mean, it's taken me years to get it into a major publisher. And one of the things I've noticed that's really getting bad is their inability to read. And I don't mean like they don't know their vowels and they don't know words, but the idea of sustained, focused reading, they can't do it. Like they literally don't have the attention span to sit down and read an essay. You know, they spent 9 or 10 hours a day on their devices, and the ability to sit down and read a novel is beyond even some of my smartest kids to do. Think about all the extraordinary things that you've gained from your favorite books. And now imagine your life without the magical portal to wonderment that books provide. And we're looking at a generation that simply doesn't walk through that portal. Here's a disturbing statistic. In America today, you are more likely to read a novel at 13 than at 17. They just abandon it when they get to their high school formative years.
Mr. Adams, are they just not reading novels in their language arts classes in high school?
I think it depends on the school. I think it depends on the program. Yeah. It depends on the state. But to be honest,
I actually know the research that says the longer you spend with technology, the more your brain actually becomes unable to read. You start to develop brain patterns physically. So your physiology of your brain makes you less and less likely to be able to read, less and less likely to be able to understand, to make connections, and in fact, to think.
So that's exactly right. And it's funny, one of the things I did to prepare for this podcast today is I happen to have a brilliant oldest daughter who is a beautiful writer, maybe the best young writer I've ever met. I know I'm totally biased. She is also an avid reader. I mean, she would read novels where she would go to the backyard and she'd get the novel and she'd walk around the shallow end of the swimming pool for 3 or 4 hours, you know, in the summer and just read. I mean, that's how she read The Kite Runner, was cover to cover. I've never been able to do that. But I talked to her about it. I said, why do you think people your age just, they don't read novels, they don't read books? And she said, it's very simple. Our brains have been rewired. The kind of neuroplasticity, to use a fancy term, is becoming very real in the lives of young people where their brains have been focused constantly on these kind of endorphins that get released with the short video, the memes, the vines, the 2 minutes, 3 minute videos that they can't sit down and give the attention and the detail and the nuance to reading an actual novel. I think in the book, I talk about this. So there was an article in The Atlantic that attention spans have become so bad for even 20 somethings that they can't even sit down and watch TV. They put it on speed and a half because they want to get through it. The idea of just sitting there and watching a show is not enough stimulation to them, much less words on a page. I am an unapologetic book romantic. You know, Thomas Jefferson said that a room without books is like a body without a soul. And, you know, books changed my life. How many great men and women in history will tell you this is the book that did it for me? You know, Alexander the Great had the Iliad under his pillow every night. Somebody once asked Abraham Lincoln, how are you able to give such great speeches? And he said, I mastered Euclid. I mean, everybody can kind of go to a book or books that really defined them. For me, it was the great Russian novelist Tolstoy that changed my life. And I just can't imagine not having that resource to fill me in. I mean, there really is a hollowing out of the youthful soul when they don't have that.
Yes, yes. The great questions that are perennial to the human condition. Who am I? Where have I come from? Where am I going? Cannot be filled in by social media. A constant stream of novelty is not the same as a rich and meaningful existence. And books provide this contact with minds that are greater than ours. They put us in contact with different ways of thinking. people we disagree with, minds that are larger or smaller than ours. It enlarges our existence to read. Perhaps our young people are hollowed out because they're riding this cresting wave of novelty. Mr. Adams, you write, "We want our students to be ravenous for insights, greedy for knowledge, excited by the prospect of greater understanding and accomplishment. But all too often, we are met by a wall of indifference, as if these human attributes and desires are no longer important or have gone missing." Isn't it a hallmark of young people to search for meaning? I mean, isn't that what young people do? They search for the meaning of life and the meaning of their life. What has happened? So where has that gone?
Very simple. The kind of great questions, you know, what Dostoevsky called the eternal questions, have been replaced by a kind of cult of frivolity. If you can constantly be entertained, if you can constantly be stimulated, if you can constantly look at something that keeps boredom at bay, that, you know, that space that we all have as human beings. And I don't want to get too dark and real deep on your podcast today, but I want you to
be
think
dark.
About, okay. I mean, I want you to think about the thoughts that come to you when you're alone by yourself before you go to sleep, on the drive into work, when you are going through some kind of crisis in your life.
Yeah.
And that space where your mind is able to roam, you're able to feel these deep passions and your mind is able to wonder. And that's when you kind of almost intellectually, cerebrally stumble upon insights and questions and yearning. C.S. Lewis talked about, you know, we're creating a generation of men without chests. And, yeah. And that is largely what I'm afraid of, is that, you know, you said, don't young people worry about the meaning of life? No, they don't, because they don't think there is a meaning to life, because they don't believe in objective truth. I mean, we have created a generation that believes in a kind of radical subjectivism, that we talk about my truth, not the truth. We talk about the highest value for young people today is not living noble lives of striving and purpose and honor and truth. The highest value is tolerance, right? Which I believe in tolerance, by the way. I absolutely believe in tolerance. I believe in a pluralistic, multicultural society where we allow for robust differences of lifestyles and opinions. But we do those things so that we can come to a greater understanding of perspective in pursuit of truth. That's John Stuart Mill. That's Thomas Jefferson. Those ideas that truth is out there and we need many minds to pursue it has been replaced with a sense of, not only do I have a right to my own opinion, but young people now believe that they have a right to be right. Now think about that. If you believe that you have a right to be right, then you don't want a book to challenge you. You don't want a teacher to challenge you. If somebody challenges you, then they're doing harm to you. Whereas you and I probably believe, if I have a bad opinion, I want somebody to challenge me so I can replace error with truth. That's not how young people see it today.
What do you see is going on in our schools? In your chapter, Hollowed Out Schools, you say the real issue is less about whether a school is a public school, a charter school, or a private school. There's only so much a school can do to compensate for the lack of positive influences and relationships in a student's life.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I've noticed is that I think a lot of people who kind of share probably my political persuasion love to bash schools, love to say, oh, look at the schools, look at all the zinginess and the critical race theory and this and that, and look at these public schools that are just going nuts. And by the way, I'm not saying that schools don't have their problems, but here is a truth that is very, very inconvenient. Sound like Al Gore right now, but here is here's a reality. You know what decides if a student is successful in school? Over 90% of it happens before they enter school in the first place. And
talk
so
about
when you,
that.
Yeah. So when you look at, here's an amazing statistic. When you look at the amount of time that a young person spends at school between the ages of 5 and 18, 91% of that time is not in school. It's somewhere else. It's in a neighborhood. It's with friends. It's with whatever family unit they have. It's profoundly unrealistic to assume that the 9% that students spend at school can compensate if you have a 91% that doesn't value education, that doesn't have this notion of you get up in the morning, you act respectful. Education is the door to the American dream. Right is right, wrong is wrong. There are certain habits and values that lead to success. What I really want my readers and I want your listeners to understand, what would, I think, shock the normal everyday American is just how untethered the average American child is to adults. They don't live their life around adults. I have a whole section in the book about how young people, I use the phrase the family dinner. They have no idea what I'm talking about. With COVID, they spent a year and a half away from teacher adults. A lot of young people grow up with a single parent who's working three jobs, trying to have ends meet. They don't eat meals with their families. They don't go to church with their families. So they're literally not around adults. They're on their phones 9 or 10 hours a day, watching other children, absorbing juvenile behavior, juvenile humor, juvenile expectations, juvenile values. And when that happens, you don't understand how to be an adult. I mean, we are human beings. We learn by the examples in front of us. And there is a profound, colossal dearth of good models for young people. They are untethered to adult role models, adult values, adult expectations. And as a result, they don't grow up. You know, there's that great book written a few years ago called The Vanishing American Adult. Well, that's because you have to teach young people what it looks like, what it means. Schools are reflecting this kind of lack of value when the young people show up at their schools.
So you're saying there aren't enough adults in an ongoing way in our students' lives, showing young people what it's all about, such that when they get to school, it's all up to the teacher. And we're seeing that all the wraparound services out there just aren't going to be enough.
You know, in economics, we talk about inputs and outputs. Our society only wants to talk about outputs. Look at these test scores. Look at what these children know. Look at what they think. But we don't want to have the difficult conversation about inputs, because that's really hard. That's parents. That's culture. That's society. That's a lot of difficult things that we don't know how to fix. And yet inputs are the most important ingredient in what decides what your output is. Does that make any sense?
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
You talk about how kids come home and everybody goes to their room with their phones and eats separately with their devices, even if everyone's home. You've talked about too, wanting to become an adult and taking on adult roles means that you've been A, around adults, as you're talking about. And B, it also means that there's something admirable about being an adult. Yeah. There's something good about being an adult that compensates for how much self-sacrifice being an adult involves. But there's a lost, I don't know, do you want to say something about that? There seems to be a lost narrative that when I give myself, like the paradox that when I give myself, I actually am filled up.
That's exactly right. No, that's a beautiful way to say it, by the way. And what I would say to you is we have a whole generation of young people who want the car keys before they get the license, right? So they want freedom to do whatever it is they want to do. But we don't give them the values, the virtues, the wisdom, and the modeling to know how to use that freedom well, so that freedom leads to a good and meaningful life. You see, freedom requires guardrails. Freedom requires wisdom. And you and I understand freedom as well. Freedom means that I get to believe whatever I want to believe. Freedom means I get to love whoever I want to love. Freedom means I get to pursue whatever goals and ideals and aspirations I want to pursue. But we understand that we use our freedom to attach to what we want to attach to. And those attachments give life its meaning, its purpose, its grandeur. This is a generation that doesn't see it that way. They see freedom as the ability to not attach to anything, right? And so if you look at it, this is a generation, they don't attach to relationships. As I said before, I mean, can you believe half of all 18 to 35 year olds don't have a romantic relationship? They don't go to the movies, they don't go to football games. They are the least patriotic generation in American history. And it's not because they're the only generation to realize that we have a pretty awful racial past. We've known that for a long time. Sorry, kiddos, you're not special. We are well aware that there've been some really awful episodes in our country. So they're not particularly attached to their country. 1 out of 5 millennials think that the American flag is a symbol of hatred. You know, 18 to 29 year olds have a better view of socialism than capitalism. And most of all, religion. When you exist in this bubble of radical individualism, and that's what I call it in the book, when you believe that freedom is the freedom to not attach to anything, you exist in a bubble of radical individualism, religion is definitely not going to be for you, because religion speaks in a language of commandments, liturgies, dogmas. It's saying you're free, but to be fulfilled and saved, you have to use your freedom in a certain way. Young people don't want to be told how to use their freedom. They want,
because they've defined freedom already as the freedom to be able to choose anything at any time. Then something from religion is just going to sound like an alienation to that ability to choose anything,
to have a bubble around them where no one tells them what to do or how to seek the good or how to find happiness.
Or it's worse than that.
Freedom is just to not attach oneself to anything.
Right. And it's even worse than that. It's the freedom to literally be free from any judgment either. So, I mean, what I had this really disturbing conversation in class where we were talking about world religions, and there were a number of students who believe, I mean, and I'm not making this up, they believed that when you die, what happens is whatever you think is going to happen. Like, literally, you are your own God, and you get to project that in perpetuity. I mean, to say that that is a me-centered view of reality is a profound understatement.
So you're saying your students thought that they were basically like, choose your own adventure, choose your own afterlife. You just, whatever you believe, that's what happens for all eternity. You kind of just decide, self-creative eternity.
But if you think about it from their perspective, it makes sense, because you and I would say, well, I mean, some people, I mean, there is an objective truth. So, you know, if anybody who's religious is wrong and they think they're going to see Jesus or Muhammad or experience, you know, some kind of transcendent enlightenment, and then it's just darkness forever, then we can say, well, they were wrong, right? Or if people who are atheists, they die and there is something, we would say objectively, they were wrong. This generation believes that literally you project your own truth. You project your own reality. And so if you believe that, then nobody has anything to teach you, right? There is no barometer beyond the self. And you and I both know that when you are the center of your own universe, that is a fast track to misery. And that's exactly why they're miserable, is they're not attached to meaningful things. I mean, this is why I would say that classical education teaches us that human beings are human beings. The rest is just window dressing. Human beings reach fulfillment the same way today than they did 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. Just because we have, you know, a different regime and lots of gadgets and gizmos does not mean that the human soul is nourished any differently. And yet we've allowed this kind of infantilization to permeate our culture and our society, and our young people are miserable as a result of it.
How did they get here, Mr. Adams? Is it their smartphones that are hollowing them out?
No, I think that the smartphones are the kerosene on a fire that was already starting to get bigger. I think that this has been happening for a long time. Again, you would have to take a giant of the culture, some titanic intellectual, to explain how the West got here. But I would argue that you look at a classical liberal culture where individual liberty is at the centerpiece of your society. And the problem is that liberty only works if you have certain ways of domesticating it and channeling it in the right way. And that's why family teaches people how to use liberty. Religion has taught people how to have liberty. Schools have taught people how to use liberty. But when those institutions are in retreat, because they are seen as impeding people's absolute liberty, then what you get is not liberty, you get licentiousness. And that's what's in display.
I definitely see that historically. I think we can say that the idea of freedom has certainly changed over time, you know, from the Enlightenment until now. It's been this growing sense, a stronger and stronger understanding that is then put into operation that freedom is license. We used to think that freedom was the ability to attach yourself to the good. I used to argue with my dad. Well, maybe not argue, but he told me this and I hated it for a while. And I sat with the idea for a couple of decades and I decided to make it my own. But the idea that freedom is not simply the ability to do whatever you want, but that freedom is what allows you to adhere to the good. And that freedom isn't free if it doesn't choose what's good.
Right. The classic example that I tell my kids, if you exercise freedom as license in regards to alcohol, the next day you're going to wake up feeling profoundly unfree. Freedom is really the power that allows us to attach ourselves to the good. The thing I didn't want to hear from my dad is that you're only free to choose the good, because only the good makes you free.
What you're saying is that it's That freedom is the ability not to attach to anything.
Right.
That what you're saying.
It's exactly what I'm saying. And what I'm saying is you see it in our schools. You know, you see it in our homes. You see it in our culture. You definitely see it in our politics. I think if people will read Hollowed Out, I think you can tell that kind of my specialty is political science, because I think that when you have a hollowed out culture and a hollowed out generation, it makes politics profoundly toxic. And here's why. If you don't identify yourself by your kin or your community or your faith or any of your friendships or any of those things, then something else is going to fill in that void. And for this generation, it's their politics. It's their political views. And so it used to be that politics was a way of simply having a conversation. Now, if politics has filled that void of meaning, when somebody disagrees with you, the stakes are much higher now, aren't they? Right? If somebody disagrees with you, it's not just that they disagree with you about marriage or about the corporate tax rate. You can characterize that disagreement as now you are against me personally. You know, if you vote against me, if you vote for a candidate I don't like, that's an existential threat to me now. And that really toxifies the political landscape in a way that's not helpful. I find that young Americans.
Yeah, like politics has really become a theory of everything. It's become quasi-religious. You know, yes. It tells me how to live my life in the details accept and who I must reject. And
exactly. It's quasi-religious. Yeah. I mean, like, these are the good people. These are the bad people. Here's what you have to do to be good. Here's what a utopian society or salvation will look like. And by the way, both sides are doing this, by the way, because right. What you do is you right. cast the other side, not as good-hearted Americans who I disagree with, but as your enemy who want to destroy you and the country. And
it's actually a return to Puritanism in a weird way, right? So we must cast out what is the evil from among us.
right. And if,
whatever it is.
And what you see is something interesting. What I see now is it used to be that you won election by making a case, by like convincing people in the middle, look, my ideas, my policies are better for you. You'll have a better life. Your families will flourish. Vote for me. And I'm going to get that middle voter, right? The one who's not necessarily a Democrat or a Republican, but kind of that between the 45-yard lines in the football field. Now, what we've done, because politics has become quasi-religious, what we do now is instead of winning the middle voter, we try and extend the extremes, right? We try and say, I think there are more people who agree with me, but the way to get them is to anger them, is to make them rowdy, is to rouse their passion. How do you do that? You don't do that with a positive, empowering view of the other side. You do that by terrifying somebody. You know, Thomas Jefferson once said that every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. And yet now we're saying the other side is a difference of principle and they do want to destroy you. And that's how they're trying to get, you know, bigger bases. So the whole way that we win elections has become very toxic. And I think largely because, you know, people who don't have other fixtures of meaning in their lives have now gone to social media, they've gone to politics, they've gone to ideology, then they enter the political arena, and now we see what happens.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about antidotes?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, it'd be kind of no fun if I didn't have any ideas about that. But you know, honestly, if you've listened to what we've talked about, I think none of them are going to shock anybody. But I would say a few things. Number one, the most obvious thing is the adults have to start adulting again. We have removed ourselves from the physical, mental, and moral space of our young people. We have got to reinsert that again. Now, if that means taking devices away, we take devices away. If that means we need to make sure we have more dinners together, that's what that means. There's no panacea, and it's obvious. But the problem is the solutions are all hard. I mean, They're all hard. And it's much
who wants
easier.
To take their kid's phone away? Boy, that would be a nightmare.
Exactly. Then you got to play kid. With your kid. Then you got to play with them because
then you got to pay attention to them. You got to be so involved.
Well, but here's the thing: a generation ago, you didn't have to because they knew how to entertain themselves. Right? They went outside. They read books. I mean, it's a weird world when I want my kid to watch a TV show. Right? I don't want you on your phone. I don't want you watching YouTube and TikTok videos. These are all hard solutions. So that's the first thing. is the adults putting themselves back in the space.
So I just had a conversation with my daughter's dental hygienist today. I was reading your book as she was getting her teeth cleaned and like making comments under my breath as I read it. She wanted to know what I was reading. And I was telling her about the argument you were making that our young people have been hollowed out, and that one of the ways that one of the large ways they've hollowed themselves out is through so much technology use. And she says that her 9 and 13-year-olds did not know what to do with themselves when the power went out last night. There was a big thunderstorm and their power was out for a while. And she just couldn't believe how unable they were to do anything with their time. She says they tend to recover from this. They get super angry if she takes their devices away.
Oh, yeah. But
when she shoves them outside, they recover. It's like they get their brain back. They get their mind back. And she says for too long, she's let them have at their devices. She's had to teach them basic human things, like she's had to teach them how to microwave things.
Oh, yeah.
She's had to teach them you can't put metal in the microwave. Oh, no, honey. See, this has metal on it. That's why the microwave is sparking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she's like, I have got to teach them basic things. I thought they had just absorbed, but they haven't. They haven't absorbed these basic details of functioning.
Well,
functioning as a human.
That's exactly right. And two things I'll say about that. The first one, and because my middle daughter will never listen to this podcast, I can talk about it a little bit. So, you know, nobody, you know, tell my daughter about this, but you know, she's learning how to drive. And I had this problem with my first daughter quite a bit, but for the second daughter, it's even worse. She doesn't know how to get anywhere without navigation. Nowhere. So we're driving to school the other day. She's, you know, she's driving the car and I'm holding on to the bar, hoping to God, I don't, you know, and so she's like, okay, well, now how do I get to this highway? Well, you have to understand, we have lived a half mile from this highway for 10 years of her life. And she's like, now how do I get to this? I'm like, I'm not telling you. And she starts yelling. She's like, you have to tell me. I said, if you can't figure it out, there's a serious problem. She went the wrong way. We literally live a half mile. We have probably gotten on that highway 20,000 times. Doesn't know how to get there. My older daughter had the same problem. Doesn't know how to get anywhere because they don't pay attention to the world around them because they're like this all the time.
On the device.
And again, this is the case in families. This is definitely the case in the classroom. I'm a little bit of a jerk in my classes about the phones. And I tell them, look, I don't want your phones out. I don't want them out. And I don't want them out because I am greedy for your attention. I want you here. And I don't mean physically. I mean emotionally. I mean intellectually, because I believe that a classroom is a serious place where transformation and metamorphosis and wisdom can happen here. But it can't if you're constantly distracted, perpetually, manically distracted. And so my children are so distracted, they don't know how to drive around their own neighborhood. My students are so distracted, they can't focus on reading a book. And even if I do deliver a great lecture, but even then, I feel like they're not able to absorb it because they get fidgety. They're worried about their phones. They're worried about their updates. They're worried about keeping their streaks alive.
Yeah. I interrupted you to tell you about the dental hygienist. You were on your way to make another point. We were talking about antidote.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you were talking about taking away phones.
Yeah, putting
making time for family dinner. All of this is hard. Adulting is what you're talking about.
Right. Another thing I would say is that, see, I don't want to say that my book is conservative or liberal. I don't like to couch it in kind of a political gloss in any way, but I would say that it is trying to conserve traditional values and aspirations. And I think that adults have become very, very hesitant to defend traditional attachments like family and faith and friendship and community and country. And I think that adults have to begin to become much more forward-leaning in that. And because what they're getting on their phones is not that. It's not a highway to a meaningful life. In the book, there's a section where there was
It's not a highway to a meaningful life.
It's not.
Social media is not a highway to a meaningful life. It is the constant riding of the wave of now, right? You're just riding the wave of now.
Yeah. And that's again, that's fine in the moment, but that doesn't teach you how to be a good father or mother. That doesn't teach you how to be a good citizen. That doesn't teach you in a crisis of faith how to be strong. I mean, think about all the words that we don't even use anymore in our language. I was thinking about this the other day. You know, words like fortitude, Nobody talks about strength anymore. Words like wisdom. Right? We don't even use the word virtue anymore, because virtues, you have to do something to be virtuous. We use the word values, because anybody can have values. You know, we don't talk about the word prudence anymore. You know, not necessarily doing something because you're not quite sure what the result would be. All of these words and all of these benchmarks of a traditional muscular life, we've just kind of abandoned it. You see it in our kids. I mean, there was a study that came out that said that just simple things like hand strength, like this generation has the weakest handshake of any generation, because they are literally physically weak. They have lots of bones being broken, not because they're going out doing dangerous things, but because they're never doing dangerous thing, and they don't know how to move about and go out and have a sense of adventure. Like I said, the basic thesis of the book is we've hollowed out our children by not encouraging them to attach to difficult things, but the things that are meaningful things. And that's really what we've got to do.
Do you know this figure? He's recently popular, named Wim Hof. He's famous for making himself healthier and helping people to grow healthier by intentionally doing hard things like ice baths. So I think he's from the Netherlands or Denmark, and he bathes in like ice water daily. And his whole thing is that in our modern lives, we've become unhealthy because we haven't challenged ourselves enough. And so now we're doing things like intermittent fasting. We're teaching ourselves to grow hungry, to be hungry. We're looking to Wim Hof and his ice baths because we need to challenge ourselves because we've become so insulated.
I think that's right. And I think that I think that what you also see in the pivot in the culture is this expectation that things are supposed to be easy, right? Right. And they're not. I mean, I would tell you, I've been thinking a lot about my dad lately because, I loved him so much, and he passed away, and he came from dirt poverty. He had an alcoholic father. He lived in a shack. And yet my dad, he never expected anything to be easy. It wasn't easy to get his degree. It wasn't easy to take care of his parents. It wasn't easy to be an extraordinary teacher. And he was okay with that, because if it's easy, then it's not meaningful. Then it doesn't mean anything at all. And I think with a lot of the young people I encounter nowadays, like if you're a teacher who's tough, then they think you're doing something wrong. If something is not, if there is a hurdle, then they think, well, somebody else should be removing that. I shouldn't have to jump over that wealth is a birthright, that freedom should be guaranteed. And one of the things that drives me nuts is the extent to which young people think that they're living in the worst times in the history of our species. They think that the world is falling apart and how awful everything is. And it's actually quite the opposite, that you could make a strong argument that young people today, through no virtue of their own, have been born and blessed with a healthy, wealthy, free society that they did nothing to build, and yet they love to denigrate. And it's given this view that well, of course, having peace and prosperity, that's the way it's supposed to be. Having a free education, that's the way it's supposed to be. Having an economy that grows, that's the way it's supposed to be. Not understanding, of course, that millions of people have endured so much to give them these gifts. I mean, we made contact because of an essay I wrote about the death of gratitude in the American classroom. And then I've noticed that young people don't say thank you very much anymore. They don't say thank you to their teachers. They don't say thank you to their friends. When I was a newer teacher, at Christmas time, we'd get all these cards and all these presents. And nowadays, it's very paltry. And it's not because the kids aren't nice. They just assume that, well, if I'm getting a great education, if my teacher is working really hard for me and going the extra mile, well, I deserve that because that's the way it's supposed to be.
On Bright Wings here, one of the anthropological positions I operate out of and I think out of is the attitude that of the creature, that to be a creature is to be a receiver, which is to mean you've received everything. And therefore, the fundamental disposition of the creature should be gratitude. So the reason your article on gratitude struck me is that it's this forgetfulness of who we are. To be ungrateful is worse than just bad manners. It's not just bad manners, but it's to forget who we are. How do you practice gratitude within your family?
I feel like I do it. I think my daughters are much better at it than my son is. It's hard to make you practice gratitude. You know, I mean, you can only tell kids so many times, look, a lot of kids don't have this or this or this or this or this. And you should, you know, and how do you respond to this embarrassment of riches that you've been given? And, you know, I always thought that the response to that was you pass it forward, you pay it forward, you pay it forward with appreciation and gratitude looking back, and then hard work and kindness moving forward, right? That's how gratitude works. You make that pivot. And yet, you know, I find that young people, you know, they don't have that view that life is necessarily a gift. I think even if you're not religious, a lot of people kind of felt, well, you won the cosmic lottery ticket. You were born. You have this life. A lot of young people, you know, kind of agree with the Greek playwright Sophocles, who said it would have been better to have never been born in the first place than to suffer from all of these wounds and all of these miseries. If you don't think that your country is particularly wonderful, if you didn't ask for this life, then you really, why would you practice gratitude? And that's what I largely see in my students a lot. You know, it's interesting that you read that before you read the book, because, you know, when you have a big book coming out, you try and do a lot of writing and getting things published out there so that people will take an interest in you and your writing. And yet I'm very proud of that essay on its own, independent of the book. Anything else.
Yeah. We decided as a family that it wasn't enough to practice just the gratitude around the table on Thanksgiving. So we try to do that whenever we sit down for dinner we talk about, what are you grateful for today? The other thing we try to do to help, it helps them to grow their decision-making, but also hopefully it helps them in discernment and wisdom. But we have this like decision-making exercise we do when we're not doing the, what are you grateful for today? We go around and we ask them, we have four children. We go around and we ask them, what's a decision that you made today? And how did it go? Did you like how it went, or did you not like how it went? Or like, what did you think that maybe you didn't make a good decision?
I love that. That's great. Yeah. I like that.
Cultivate reflectivity in them. Right. Yeah. So what did I do today? How did it go? Maybe I shouldn't have done that. Wish I'd made a different decision. Even if it was like, well, I should have studied for that test or everybody likes to share successful things. So most of the time
I love that. I should do that. I should kind of do that more often. I'm going to steal some of your quotes right now.
Awesome.
And I'm going to steal some of your parenting. Yeah, no, absolutely. No, thank you. That's great. I love it.
So what do you wish parents would do regarding technology?
I wish parents would understand that technology is a tool, but it's not a panacea, right? There's nothing, you know, technology can be used for ill, or it can be used for great good. You know, one of the things I think is really interesting is when all of these new gadgets came around, 2007, 2008, 2009, you know, the commentators and the intellectuals of society, you know, the intelligentsia, thought that there was going to be this huge kind of class divide between people who are wealthy and can afford all of these devices versus poor kids versus all of the people who can't afford it. Because the thinking was, well, people who have iPads and who have these computers, the kids are going to be able to watch all these educational videos, and they're going to be able to watch and engage in all of these online learning.
So rich kids are going to get
more
rich and more successful and more educated, and poor kids who can't afford the technology won't
fall back. Now it's the opposite. Now you see that the wealthy families have, you know, they don't need to work three jobs. And so the luxury is to take them away and say, you're going to have device free time. You only get a half an hour a night, or you only get your device after you've done your homework, because the wealthier families are actually supervising their children quite a bit more. And so it's interesting how it's flopped, how the luxury is having a life and the resources to take them away. Whereas poor people, oftentimes that's the only outlet for childcare or for, you know, spending their time is to just give the device. And so you see this interesting flop between the classes.
Because wealthier families have more time because they have more money,
they can
afford to be more involved
absolutely
provide supervision. So their kids are outside.
The social science research is overwhelming. It is absolutely overwhelming that middle class to upper middle class families invest a tremendous amount of time and resources into their children. And no matter, by the way, where they live or their race or their religion, you know, that kind of two parent, two working middle to upper middle class situation where we invest heavily in our children is leading to a massive chasm between children in this country who are invested in and children who are not. And that's, like I said, that's part of the 90% equation that's happening before kids even get to
school.
Before they get to school. I mean, that's why I always say the luckiest teachers in the world are the ones who have students who show up on the first day believing that what they're doing in the classroom is valuable. Right? And it doesn't really matter why they think it's valuable. It's valuable because I need straight A's, or it's valuable because education is a road to enlightenment, or education will get me a job. It doesn't matter why the kid values the education, but the fact that that value came but on the first day before, that is a privilege to teachers who have that, because a lot of kids don't have that value.
Ah, so what you're saying is whatever we're doing at home to pour truth, goodness, and beauty into our children is one of the main important measures to prevent hollowing out. So, Mr. Adams, if we're zeroing in on an antidote, one of the things is to limit technology as much as you can with your child. As much as your means allow, make your technology serve your child's humanity. Right. What were some of the others? Eat dinner together.
Put yourself in their spaces. Yeah.
Put yourself in their spaces. What else? Was there something else, Mr. Adams?
Yeah, the last one is kind of my political science wonkery coming through. But I think as a generation, adults need to remind young Americans that being patriotic is not the same thing as thinking your country is perfect. Right? You can be patriotic without believing that perfection is what you've had as a nation. And I think that a lot of young people think that if you're patriotic, it means that you think that nothing bad has ever happened in your country, or that there's no progress that can still be made, or any of that. And that really worries me, because the United States of America does not have the traditional markers of national identity. Right? We don't have a monarch that we're all subject to. We don't have an established church. We don't all have the same language. We don't all have the same, you know, racial background. We don't have any of that. And so if you don't have a common king or race or religion or language, then what makes an American American, right? Our former national motto was E pluribus unum, out of many, we are one. Well, this generation is really good with the pluribus, but they're terrible with the unum. They don't understand that, you know, that having a common belief system, what Abraham Lincoln called a proposition, what Martin Luther King called a dream, you know, that idea of universal human justice, regardless of your background, that ubiquitous universal belief is what makes an American an American. And it is enshrined in our documents. That spirit of universal justice for all, regardless of your background, that's in our founding document, the Declaration. It's in the 14th Amendment. It's in the Gettysburg Address. It's in Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream and in Letter from a Birmingham Jail. You see it all the time in some of the better oratory of modern American politicians. This idea that our national identity transcends the accidents of our birth. That belief is what unites and yokes us together. But if young people, A, don't even know what the proposition of America is, and B, if they think that it's all a lie because we haven't always lived up to it, then I don't know what makes an American anymore.
I mean, we kind of all have an unthinking, perhaps, affection for our own place, perhaps. I mean, what I see in what you're saying too is you've expressed this great fidelity to the place that you're from, grew up there, and you're giving your life in the place where you were. It makes sense to me too that you would not want to give up not only on your local place, on your local community, but also on your larger American community, on your national community, that this place where we are, this place that we, this American project into which we've been born, that you wouldn't want to give up on that either. And that if we're going to remain neighbors with one another, we have to start engaging a different sense of identity, a deeper sense of identity.
I mean, I, and again, I don't have a problem, you know, absolutely exposing and talking about all the the parts of our history where we don't live up to our ideals. I mean, I think we need to know about that stuff for sure.
Of course.
Absolutely. But I think there is this notion with young people. Let me explain it this way. I think a lot of young people would say, okay, look at things like slavery. That's the real America. Whereas I think a lot of older Americans would say, yes, that's there. But the real America is not that. It's the Civil War. It's Abraham Lincoln. It's the 13th Amendment. Other people would look and say, you know, you have this, look at 100 years of segregation and all of this oppression. I think a lot of Americans would say, yes, that's true. That's there. But you know what America is? America is the civil rights process. It's Rosa Parks. It's the Civil Rights Act. It's the Voting Rights Act. It's the 24th Amendment. It's Martin Luther King's dream, right? That's the real
It's all
America.
These good things too. I mean, yeah. We wouldn't, as a person, I wouldn't want any person to see me as simply my faults. That's horrible. Said. Like, that's, what if you thought I was only all my faults?
Well, and that's what I
and that's what we're doing to ourselves as a national identity. We're saying our young people are saying, hey, we are the sum of our weaknesses and failures.
Yeah. And it's almost like
that's all we are.
Almost we're glorying in self-loathing. We're you know, we kind of are signaling that I'm aware of just how bad I am and how bad this country is. And the problem with that is you can't do anything with the past, right? There's nothing you can do with it except for learn from it and move on from it. And sorry, America has done a really good job of that. The progress that we have made as a society, even in my lifetime, is extraordinary. And I think traditionally Americans look at that progress and they take great pride in that and saying, look, we did have these awful things and look what we did about it because we're a free society. A free society gets to be in the driver's seat. Not a king, not a pope, not an aristocracy. The people of the country are in the driver's seat. Look what we've done. We have become a highly successful, tolerant, progressive, free society where bias and prejudice, of course, it's still there, but nothing like it was 30, 50, 300 years ago. Instead of looking at that progress and saying, I'm proud of that. Now, what can we do to keep on going? We simply look back and wallow. And so you said it beautifully. I hope that you don't define me by my worst moments and my worst episodes. I hope you define me by the fact that I moved on. I became wise. I became strong. I remedied the wrongs. And that's, I guess that would be the last thing I would say is you can be patriotic without thinking that we've been perfect.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mr. Adams, you are far from being a curmudgeon-y old teacher. Just simply from the way that you messaged me back when I first made contact with you, I was like, wow, this man is so energetic. He is so full of life. He's and clearly you love your students. Clearly you love your students and you want their lives to be full of meaning. So I can I'm able to see that, even though the book has so much that is dark and heavy in it. I can see that that you want to be the gadfly that spurs us to awareness of what's happening so that we can adult, we can step in, we can be present in their spaces and that things can be different.
Yes. I love that, by the way. Any comparison to Socrates and the gadfly, I will take that always and forever. And I do know that the book is, I mean, it's only 140 pages of real text but I do, a lot of people say it's heavy. Like it's not a, you know, you don't want to skip and leap and jump for joy. You know, the whole point of the book is that I'm not a famous person. I'm a person, an ordinary teacher in an ordinary classroom. And yet what I'm seeing is extraordinary. It isn't regular. It's not ordinary at all. It's profoundly disturbing. And yet, you know, usually when you have these big books, you know, and you have people who are talking about existential threats and colossal societal drift, it's usually famous people or celebrities or politicians. And the whole point of my book is I'm just a high school teacher, ordinary high school teacher. But what I'm seeing is profoundly vexing and disturbing and trying to sound the alarm bells for parents and frankly, anybody who cares about the direction of the country.
Yeah.
I think the first step in solving profound problems is to correctly assess and diagnose the problems. And that's really what I've tried to do as a front row seat to what I think is a declining generation that is uniquely in trouble.
Mr. Adams, thank you so much for your care for your students and for your passion for this project. Thank you for talking with me.
This was great fun. Thank you so much.
In this parent-teacher conference with Mr. Adams, were you able to identify any areas of growth for you and for your young people, for your children? One thing I wonder is, what can you do that you will do without wanting to bite off more than we can chew? What can we do that we will also, in fact, actually do? As a small shout out to Ralphie Jacobs at Simply On Purpose, I've been trying to connect with my children for the past month. Each child, 3 minutes in the morning, 3 minutes after school, and 3 minutes before bed. Connect with them in meaningful ways, not task-oriented, but just relationship-oriented. Totally honest admission, I have not been reading to my twins very well for the past couple of weeks before bed. These are just small examples of the ebb and flow of family life. But of course, we want our children to be filled up with meaning. We want them to be well-rounded, full people, full of meaning. And in this case, as Mr. Adams has pointed out, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So perhaps you're in the stage where you actually rather the antidote is really the same as the preventative. What can we do to reinsert ourselves into the physical, emotional, social spaces of our children? I struggled in my relationship with my dad, and I knew even as a teen that the thing that we needed to do, which was the very thing that we didn't particularly want to do, was we needed to spend more time, not less time together. We need to do the hard work that Mr. Adams talked about. We need to do the hard work of adulting. We need to undertake the hard work of teaching our children how to have quality relationships. This is not going to be something we will ever regret. In the show notes, I'm going to be listing resources on how to have family dinner or how to have a family meal. It doesn't have to be dinner. It's a link to an organization called thefamilydinnerproject.org. They give you everything from recipe ideas to conversation starters to research on how important it is to connect with your children in the context of a meal. Strangely enough, it's actually really good for the mental health of parents as well. Also in the show notes, I wanted to give you a link to an organization called 1000 Hours Outside, which challenges families and children to spend lots of time outside. 1000 Hours Outside also tells you so much information about all of the plethora of benefits to mental, physical, emotional, educational health that spending lots of time outside gives us. And finally, I encourage you to dive into what Jeremy Adams is saying, into what he is writing. He's allowed me to repost an article that he wrote for Public Discourse on the death of gratitude in the American classroom. In the show notes, I also linked several more of his other pieces. I encourage you to get a hold of a copy of Hollowed Out, A Warning About America's Next Generation. It's available through a link in the show notes also. Please share this book, share this podcast with teachers that you know, anyone involved in education, parents, mothers, fathers, and school administrators. Hand them a copy and tell them that you want to help them find a solution. Perhaps you were born for such a time as this.